The Avengers Follow the White Rabbit is a podcast dedicated to practical politics. Practical politics is, of course, called practical politics because it is all non-voting, which makes it very, very practical. Conventional politics is always rule-based politics. Every 2 years, every 4 years, it's basically what you do at the voting booth. And then there is full-spectrum practical politics, or engaging and taking down an opponent by any means necessary, using the rules, but never breaking the rules. But to do anything, we have to start with practical politics, and in this case, it's the art of staying on message. It's having a consistent message. And our consistent message is a mantra, or white rabbit genocide you see on this front page. And we will also, in this podcast, engage in the geopolitical. We will talk about geopolitical events. We will talk about things from a unique white rabbit perspective. We will also go into white rabbit psychology and ecology and talk about everything you'd want to know about the indigenous white rabbits of Europe. And this is, again, the Horus the Avengers, Follow the White Rabbit. We're going to talk a bit about double standards. I'm going to talk about some funny double standards. One of the more interesting double standards on the planet is Africans. Yeah, Africans love freedom of association around non-Africans. It's pretty ironic. Most of the most white people want freedom of association around white people. Most Japanese want freedom of association around Japanese. But many of these non-European groups, and Africans especially demonstrate this, will pretty much go to their death to try to have freedom of association around white people. It's very funny. Freedom of association is wonderful, just not in Africa. Now, when's the last time you saw an African show up in China, in fact? I'll even go out of a white country. In China, they have a whole city full of Africans, and they're starting to send them back. And some of them have lived there for a long time, and they're trying to stay there. They're saying it's human rights violations, it's this and that, and they're going to court there and all kinds of stuff. But they want freedom of association around Chinese. They don't want to go back to Africa. They don't want freedom of association around Africans. You know, in America, the Africans in America were segregated. In my opinion, they were better off segregated because then they could run many of their own affairs, like their own school system and stuff like that. They weren't being experimented on. They weren't going through a bunch of social engineering, which has probably done way more damage to them. In fact, it has done way more damage to them than any amount of segregation. But anyways, they pretty much got them all marching in the streets so they could have freedom of association around white people. It's funny stuff. It's funny. They could easily have gotten on a plane. I'm sure people would have paid for it. That's what Marcus Garvey wanted to do. And go back to Africa. And even right now, if you're black, you can go to Ghana and get free land and get you can grow three crops a year there. It's pretty amazing stuff. And have all the freedom of association you want. But they don't want that. They want freedom of association, or a great many of them, around white people. It's kind of funny. You know, they always say the excuse, you brought us here, or yada, yada, yada. It's always something. It's always something with the non-Europeans. It's like the Mexicans. You took this land from us. It's always something. But they always want freedom of association. They want to live with you. They want to go to school with you. They want affirmative action from you. They want all kinds of goodies from you. And, of course, once they get in charge, it's another game. But they always want freedom of association. Africans are, this is now global. They want freedom of association around non-Africans. And that's the way it is if it's an African living outside of Africa. You know, they're getting on boats, dying, trying to go to Europe so they can have freedom of association around Europeans. Yeah, they don't want to stay in Africa where the land is wonderful and the natural resources are plentiful. And it's become a global problem. White people have, the do-gooding liberals and the little Jew rabbits have created a problem with these Africans. And problems get reactions, and reactions get solutions, don't they? Yeah, so it should be interesting to see how that little Chinese village, this big Chinese town full of Africans does eventually. But there are more double standards. What's funny is when you get into the Jew rabbits, let's pick on the Jews here for a minute, but when you get into the Jew rabbits, one thing is really funny. I was reading an article on David Duke, and this article is quite old. I think it's from 2005. It's Rabbi Shmuley Botich. Or Botech, and he's a famous rabbi to the stars. And the rabbi basically was sounding off in this article. He went to some J-date, some Jewish dating service, you know, where Jews get together and date so they can procreate and have more babies. Now, you would never see an Aryan dating service. An Aryan dating service, they'd probably try to kill you. Right. I mean, they'd probably try to shut down your website. They'd probably try to nuke you off the face of the earth. But anyways, Jewish dating is a big deal. They got J-Date and everything else. So the rabbi went to this Jewish dating event. And there was this good-looking, blonde Jewish girl. He described her as quote-unquote Aryan looks. And Dr. Duke points this out in his article because he always points out this double standard. Now, he pointed out, and he was really embarrassed because all the Jewish boys wanted to date this quote-unquote Jewish girl that looked Aryan, this Aryan-looking Jewish girl. And he felt embarrassed for the Jewish girls that had non-Aryan looks or traditional Jewish looks. What is interesting about this double standard, and David Duke went on to point out their historic hatred of us. What it is you get a mindset, you get a jump into Shmuley's mindset, the Rabbi Shmuley's mindset, and his hatred of us. And then he goes on to, after Hurricane Katrina, the Rabbi Shmuley's go on to say he will never forgive us for not integrating with the Africans. I mean, you got a lot of nerve. It's like saying, we'll never forgive you for not integrating with the Palestinians. You won't ever hear that. But there's a lot of double standards in there. But one of the more interesting ones is this Aryan. The Rabbi Shmuley did something that I have seen Jews do from time to time. You Aryans, or the Aryan-looking girl. But what's funny about this is the same media that allows Rabbi Shmuley to say, this Jewish girl with Aryan looks, and the reason she had Aryan looks is, according to him, she was a convert. So go figure. But anyway, she wasn't a traditional Jewish girl from the Bronx. She was an Aryan convert. But he uses this word Aryan. And I thought it was kind of hilarious because what is more common than seeing a special on the History Channel, pretty much produced out in Hollywood, saying, you Aryans don't exist? Yeah, they're blaming. Rabbi Shmuley's upset. The rabbis are upset because this Jewish girl has Aryan looks, and all the Jewish boys are lining up to date her, but they're not lining up to date the real traditional-looking Jewish girls. And then on the other side of the coin, they're producing episode upon episode of all this stuff that's saying, well, there's no such thing as an Aryan. Aryans don't exist. It's kind of funny, but it's a double standard. He knows what an Aryan looks like. Everyone does. But yet at the same time, they turn around and say Aryans don't exist. It's kind of funny, but nothing's more over the top than the double standards among the little Jew rabbits. Seriously. What's another one? Another one is the funniest one, is saying, you Palestinians create all these problems. You Palestinians don't really want a peace deal, but there's no such thing as Palestine. They'll say both things. Well, if there's no such thing as Palestine, you don't have to worry about any Palestinian peace deal. And this is the type of circular thinking they go into. It is really funny. All you have to do is go ahead and Google, there's no such thing as Palestine. You're going to see some Jews saying there's no such thing as Palestine. If you Google, there's nothing but problems with the Palestinians, you'll see some Jews saying that there's nothing but problems with Palestinians. It's their type of thinking. And this comes out in the neoconservatives. The neoconservatives always kill me with saying, Islam is invading us. Islam is taking us over. Then they'll turn around and say, but there's no such thing as us. We're just a culture. Well, Islam isn't taking anything over. Islam is a cohesive culture, a cohesive society, basically, from the top down. We are not. If that says anything. But Bob Whitaker wrote a whole entire piece about this, but it's really funny. But neocons kill me. They'll say, Islam, radical Islam is taking us over. Then they'll turn around and say, there's no such thing as us. But these double standards always kill me. And in reality, in the alternative news and research, you actually have a double standard there too. And it is an anti-white double standard. All the standards are typically anti-white. And the alternative news and research is you have it as well. If you do your homework on the alternative news and research, you'll find out that the Japanese are at the forefront visually, things you can find out about in regards to alternative energy. Japan has some interesting stuff. I've already pointed out to holograms. Japanese holographic technology is right in front of your face. Well, the Asians, the East Asians in particular, will put some of their technology right in front of their face. Europeans never do that. In the 1970s, and I'll give you a great example of this, in the 1970s, it was thought that there's no possible way you could produce a stealth aircraft. In the 1980s, the late 80s, the Russians started saying the U.S. already has a stealth aircraft, and then Saddam Hussein got lit up by a stealth aircraft. That's how Europeans operate. They're not going to show you any weaponized holograms until it's too late, until it's too late for you to do anything. And then they're going to say, oh, we can weaponize holograms after they've blown you off the face of the planet. That is typical white rabbitish type thinking. But the Asians always bring stuff out in front of the world even before they perfected it. So the Japanese are bringing out holograms, and the Japanese always talk about alternative energy. They've talked about some pretty sophisticated stuff. Do I think they have cold fusion or something like that? Who knows? But whatever they have, they usually get it from European scientists or from white scientists in America, by and large. And that's fine. The alternative news and research crowd always talks about this. They talk about Japanese. But what's funny is I've never once heard them that say the Japanese have a responsibility to share this with the world. Everyone assumes that the Japanese and all the technology that the Japanese produce through their creativity, or that they grab, you know, they grab robotics from America, which is what they did do, and then they take it to the nth power. And the Japanese, of course, everyone assumes, all the alternative news and researchers assume that the Japanese should be allowed to benefit from this. You know, Japanese children should be allowed to benefit from Japanese creativity. They don't have any moral obligation to share this with the world. But what's funny is they'll turn around when it comes to anything European, when it comes to anything white, they immediately and arrogantly assume that they have an obligation, because they're white, to share it with the world. You know, European children do not have the right, the same rights as Japanese children. In other words, Indo-European children produce these wonderful technologies with their own creativity and their own gene pool. Obviously, it's somewhat genetic. We don't see Aborigines producing it. But they don't have the same privileges as the Japanese, and that is to say the European children cannot just benefit alone from their own technology. They have to share things for the world. And this comes out at the UN. The UN would never in a million years take Japan to task for not sharing with them semiconductor technology. No, they wouldn't dare take it up with the Taiwanese. You know, you have a real advanced semiconductor industry. The Koreans have a real advanced LCD industry. The Japanese are real advanced with robotics. You have to share that with the world. They never say that. They'll always say, you developed countries need to share with us more. But they're only talking about white countries. And the alternative news and researchers fall prey into this. I mean, Hoagland, I think it's Richard Hoagland, he always does this type of stuff. These evil Western elites have this technology and they won't share it with the world. Well, bears don't need fishing rods. Bears don't need fishing rods. If they needed them, they'd already have them. And Aborigines don't need Facebooks. They don't need Facebooks. They don't need semiconductors. If they needed them, they'd be running around scouring us, taking our secrets, like the Japanese did with robotics, taking it back to Japan, and just like the Japanese did, or taking it back to the little Aborigine cubholes in the rainforest and developing it from there. They don't do that because they don't have any interest in it. And it's profoundly arrogant to say that the Japanese, and they always do this, it's the biggest double standard in alternative news and researchers. The Japanese have the privilege to develop their own technologies and to benefit from them, but European children don't. If European children develop a technology, well, guess what? They have to share it with the world. They have to share it with the world. And they're going to save the world with it. And if anything, whether it be, they never learn. This is the same group that talks about the destructive nature of taking Christianity and bathing the world in blood with it, killing all the Aborigines and forcing them under Christianity. Or even forcing them under some, they're not saying that, but environmentalism is the same dogma. They're forcing the third world under some environmental dogma. It's the same thing. Now, of course, they want to take them some advanced technology. If you can learn anything from our past, learn that interfering at all on any form, in any way, shape, manner, form, if you take them Facebook, it's going to harm them in some level if they didn't produce it themselves. If you can't take robotics, run with it, and do your own thing with it like the Japanese, you have no business fooling with it. Trying to give them some advanced form of energy like nuclear fusion or something like that, it isn't going to work. It isn't going to work, but they don't learn. They're going to solve all the world's problems and give everyone free energy. The Japanese, of course, they would never in a million years talk about the Japanese having to give everyone some new discovery they make in energy. No, that goes to benefit Japan first. But anything Indo-European children have, well, they got to give that to the world. They got to save the world with that. All the Dick Hoaglands. They're crazy. They're insane. They never learn. Europeans have a tendency. We tend to universalize. We tend to universalize against any type of benchmark. So it doesn't matter if we create Christianity. We got to universalize it. If we create some new environmental faith, some environmental dogma, they're going to universalize it. If they have some new form of energy or physics, they're going to try to universalize it. This is a disease. You can't universalize what you are. You can't. That's the problem to begin with, but they never get it. So if I were to ever write a book, it would be about this dangerous double standard and the fact that Europeans, as much as they say they get it, never get it. Bears don't need fishing poles, and Aborigines don't need Facebook. They don't need it. If they need it, they'd already have it. You can only take them so far. If the Japanese are running around grabbing robotics technology or stealing it, or stealing something, something like cold fusion from America or from the Germans, or taking it from the Germans, develop it for themselves, well, that's fine. That's some amount of motivation. I mean, if they're smart enough to get in and steal it and take it and develop it, fine, so be it. But this double standard of the East Asians are allowed to advance technologically and their gene pool is allowed to benefit from that. But anything the Europeans do, European children should not be allowed to benefit from that first. We have to let the whole world benefit from that. This is garbage. One false small step for man, one giant step for the planet. Well, in reality, it's one giant step for white rabbits, and then it's a giant step for the world. But one of the challenges we made in the past, one of the big problems, is we never defined who it was making that first big step. And that mistake is not going to happen again. And that's why you're not going to see those technologies. They're not going to be walking around giving them to the world, nor are the Japanese. Thank goodness for that. But this double standard kills me among the alternative news and researchers because they don't even see it. They see the harm done by trying to kill everyone or bathing the natives in blood, teaching them Christianity, converting them to Christianity, but they don't see the harm in trying to give them advanced technology they could not develop on their own. You know, I don't have a problem with Russia selling Iran nuclear technology. I really don't, because we're all equal. Well, if we're all equal, they should all have little nuclear warheads, just like Israel, just like everyone else. You know, this whole entire dynamic of one step for man and one giant step for mankind, this dynamic that has played itself out in the West, is really a racial dynamic, and it is within Europeans. It's really one giant step for white rabbits, and then the rest of the world kind of rides on our coattails. But the rest of the world is going to get a wake-up call that is our coattails. Just like the Japanese believe that their technology should benefit themselves first, a lot of these the Richard Hoagland types are going to get a wake-up call. Our race is going to be benefiting from our technology first. No one else is going to. That's the way it's going to work. You don't like that? Tough. Tough. I'm in full agreement on that. And plus, it's too dangerous. They don't get it. They understand the danger of taking Christianity and bathing Aborigines in blood and converting them to Christianity. They understand that. They understand the damage done, but they're willing to make the same mistake over and over again. And this technology, of course, some of this technology is extremely dangerous. Way more dangerous than nuclear. But that's funny. I would prefer us work it out with nuclear technology. All this big dynamic over Iran's nukes. I prefer us, and Israel's nuke and all these countries wanting nuclear warheads. I prefer us work it out over nuclear technology than to have this dynamic still around when it comes to, when it comes to some of the free energy technologies. Yes. But that is a funny double standard. And there are many double standards, but double standards are quite interesting. Now I'm going to go into some news and views, and we're going to answer questions at the same time. Let's talk a minute about the Pink Rabbit Banksters and Elitesters and some news from North America. I'm going to answer questions and talk about news at the same time. Right now, housing prices in America just keep falling. It's like... I believe that the percentage is identical to the Depression, the Great Depression. One of the problems for our enemies is the lender of last resort. The lender of last resort. One of the challenges with private central banking is it finagles everything. And when you start finagling everything, when you loan money into circulation, the interest on the money, the interest on the little note, the U.S. Treasury note in your pocket that you call the U.S. dollar, the interest on the note is going to far outpace the amount of notes in circulation because of the compound nature of interest. What they have done in the crash of 1987, if you go back in time, they solved one of their biggest problems, the lender of last resort. The Federal Reserve came in and opened up the discount window and flooded the system with liquidity and allowed the stock market to bounce back. They were paper assets. Inventing a lender of last resort or getting a lender of last resort together for paper assets, bonds, notes, government bonds, what have you, has always been pretty easy for them, especially in the digital age. If you do your homework in the crash of 1998, the Asian collapse, the lender of last resort was taken to the nth power, and even in places like Hong Kong. Central bankers around the world have learned some techniques to deal with this lender of last resort problem. But the challenge with the lender of last resort, is not in the gold and silver prices. They would have had that covered. It's not in the, what's funny in America is if you look at the financial news over the last 30 years, say, it's always foreigners are going to sell our bonds and destroy things. Foreigners are going to sell our bonds. There's more U.S. debt owned by U.S. institutions within the U.S., and that means the Federal Reserve, than the foreigners. You know, forget about Chinese U.S. Treasury note holdings. You would have to understand what exactly the U.S. Federal Reserve and all the government institutions, the Fannie Mae's, the Freddie Mac's, all the different pension funds, all the different mutual fund companies own in regards to U.S. government debt. And then you'd have to, then you look at the numbers. The number's like $6 trillion or something. It's an outrageous number. To get the full story, you'd have to audit the Federal Reserve. And that's never been done, and I think the thing would collapse and then we'd have to audit it first or something. But anyways, that has never happened. All this stuff that the financial gloom and doomers say has really never occurred because of the lender of last resort. The problems they express, which are legitimate. It's legitimate. When you have foreigners and you have all this debt, it's the nature of the beast. They're going to know that. That's a problem. But what they see as a problem, they've already plotted a solution. Yeah, the powers that be have already provided a solution to gold and silver prices and all that other type of stuff. But what has always hit them between the eyes is the lender of last resort. And U.S. housing is something that is a problem. They've known about this for quite some time. If you go back, you'll find out that at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, this is in Chicago, Illinois, they came out with housing futures. They've always tried to develop a secondary market for housing, a housing futures, some type of way to engineer a lender of last resort for hard assets because you're dealing with brick and mortar. You know, it's a lot easier to sell your stock in Ford Motor Company or your stock in General Electric I'm talking about your actual stock certificates. You can get on E-Trade and you can buy and sell that stock on General Electric. That's a hell of a lot easier than selling your house. Selling your house takes time, and there's a liquidity problem. In other words, when you go to sell your house and you need to sell your house the most, you most need to sell your house, you're in financial trouble, well, you're probably less likely to be able to sell it. Stocks don't necessarily work like that unless they're going, even at General Motors at $2, you could sell General Motors before they went belly up, before they were taken off the New York Stock Exchange and restructured. Houses aren't like that. You know, right now there's periods in America with no buyers. It's a lender of last resort problem. And so guess what? The banks have nothing to do with it. The banks can't really do anything. There's not an active secondary market. There's not a forward market like a futures market, although they've tried to develop it. This has been a problem for a long time. What happens when housing goes like it is in America, it has a huge spiral effect. Not only does it affect the actual psychology of the owner, because they can't sell it. If you want to get rid of your house, you can't, unless you're willing to take nothing for it. So a lot of times they let them go back to banks. And it's a huge spiral problem. But there's a secondary problem, and that is, as housing prices go down, property taxes have to be adjusted. The problems come in with school taxes and all this stuff that goes together with housing prices. And now you have all these municipalities who are basically running on fumes from a huge housing bubble that was created really over the past 30 years. Housing prices, and especially over the last 10 or 15, that has all come apart post-2008. So it's a spiral effect. As housing prices decline, not only do you have the psychology of the owners, not only do you have them leaving their mortgages with the local banks, you don't really have an effective secondary market to sell these huge pools of houses. It is a huge disaster. There's no lender of last resort. If you go to the Soroses, if you listen to the problem they always talk about with these private central banks, the problems that they enter into, it is one challenge, the lender of last resort. They solved that brilliantly when it came to financial assets, but they've never ever solved it with hard assets, with brick and mortar. There is no lender of last resort for the U.S. housing. There's no way out of the mess. There's no way to rig a... There's no way to open up a discount window and flood the place with money. You'd have to do a whole totally restructuring of the the free market system for housing or something. I don't know how they would finagle a way out of it. They couldn't do it. They can't do it. This is the problem they faced. The problem they faced is not what most people think. It's always something else. But this spiral that has happened at the municipal level, all these cities on the eve of bankruptcy and all these states, this has led to a new problem for them. You see, they're used to, for the last X many centuries, they haven't had money problems. You know, the parties in London, our enemies, the Pink Rabbit Banksters, do not have money problems. They've always had lots of enemies, but they don't have money problems. If you've been used to not having money problems for the last three centuries, and now your whole entire group is thrown for a loop, basically because of a classic problem, a lender of last resort problem dealing with U.S. real estate. And they have to have the U.S. They're sitting at the top of the U.S. They're controlling all this stuff, but they have a problem, a lender of last resort problem. It's a classic problem. If you look up Soros, if you read any of his books, he talks about this type of stuff. It is a huge problem in housing. But if you're not used to having money problems and you're faced with money problems, it affects you psychologically. You know, this is something they've been dealing with. So I was asked questions, do I think they're really upset about it now? No, whatever they had to agree to a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, they knew about this. They're not stupid. They know exactly where their problems are. Their problems are a stock market collapse. Their problem isn't necessarily a stock market collapse. Their problem is a stock market collapse that isn't orderly, that gets out of hand. And they can solve that with a lender of last resort. They could throw open the discount window. They got enough international partners. Their problem is someone dumping U.S. bonds. Well, it would hurt in the short term, but they got a lot. They own more bonds than China does. This is fear of China, fear of China. That's a bunch of social engineering nonsense to keep the American people suspended. And yeah, they got a deal going with China. Moving operations to China, that's easier said than done. there's two sides to China. But this particular problem of U.S. housing was a problem they faced and have faced, and it's become a tidal wave because of the secondary ramifications of cities and states going bankrupt and everything else. And housing prices got out of hand. Guess what? Property taxes got out of hand. That means municipalities got out of hand with how much money they had how much money they were used to operating under. You know, governments don't produce; they can just levy taxes, but they have to provide goods and services for what they levy taxes for. So you have the local garbage contracts. You have all this huge mess in America at the municipal level created all by and large of the housing collapse, and it is a collapse. It's a collapse that is outright turning into a rout in many areas. They're talking about it bouncing back, but it won't. They're talking about the U.S. economy bouncing back, but you can't bounce back until you work off this hard asset bubble that has now been punctured, and there is no lender of last resort for it. There's no way they just can't open up a discount window and prop up housing prices like stock prices. They can't, and now it's starting to wear psychologically on. Because of the secondary factors, school cutbacks, police cutbacks. If you look it up, it's disastrous. But they would have had to plan for this a couple years ago, because guess what? They knew it was coming. They had a good idea it was coming. Now what they agreed to, that's one thing or another. I was asked another question, and I'll tie this all in together. Someone has listened to these MP3s. A handful of people have always commented, well, you're not time-driven, you're event-driven. That's true. That's true. My formal training probably is in some type of risk management. Risk management, let me give you a classic example of risk management. Well, we're talking right now on a computer, over air and ether on the internet. And on the internet, you have a lot of young guys, and gals called, hackers and, people that defend against hackers. And, what's interesting about this group is it's all risk management. Risk management is all event driven. It doesn't matter whether you're in the military, you're on Wall Street, you're defending a website. You're all event-driven. If event A happens, you have to know what to do. You have to have things ahead of time. You have to know what to do ahead of time. If event B happens, you have to know what to do. You have to know if A, B, C, D, or E happens, well, we got to do E, F, G, H, whatever. You got to have the plan ahead of time. That's what risk management is if you've ever been in the military. They will drill you over and over again. That is all event-driven. If the enemy's shooting this way, or if we're taking over a city this way, and these events happen, you have to know to do this. You know, it's all event-driven. It's not necessarily time-driven. Because events can happen that throws everything out of a loop. Well, our enemy is very much event-driven, too. They look for a series of events from, let's say, the late 70s or late 60s all the way to 2050 so they get their New World Order. They're looking for events. They're looking to play events over and over again until they have their New World Order. And there's different groups. Different groups argue about that on their side, so on and so forth. But one of the problems they've always faced is what happens if the deadly event happens, which always catches them off guard. And that's the lender of last resort, the dreaded problem. What happens if some bubble gets out of line, like a housing bubble, and because we don't have a housing futures, we don't have a forward market, we don't have a way to shove liquidity in there. Once it starts, once it pops, you gotta let it work it off, and they can take years. In California, I wanna say it was the late 70s, there was a housing bubble, mini housing bubble in places like San Diego, California. And it took all the way to the mid-90s, for the thing to work itself off. It can take a decade and a half or two decades, and this is one of the biggest the world has ever seen. So they would have to know about this particular event. This is a kink in the armor. This is one of many, and there has been many, but this is a kink in the armor. But no, I am all event-driven. I'm not timeline-driven. I'm not timeline. I'm looking for certain events that are going to trigger other events. But the interesting thing about risk management, one of the fascinating things when you look at the hackers and the kids defending the young people or old people defending website, and that is one of the interesting things, is the age. Age doesn't really matter. What matters is ability. To manage risk, you have to have the right insight. It doesn't really matter all your degrees. That can help you. It can hurt you. It can create arrogance. It doesn't matter if you don't have a degree. That can help you in so much as it can make you humble. It can also hurt you in so much as it can put a chip on your shoulder. I don't have a degree and I can defend a website, yada, 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 whatever. everything that you think becomes a strength, can become a strength, can also become a weakness. And in risk management, it comes out really quickly. In the military, military is the ultimate of managing risk because you're actually managing lives. On Wall Street, they manage financial risk, or some do, some don't. When it comes to managing risk, you have to know where you're wrong. If you're defending a website and you're trying some defense against some Trojan, and I don't know what I'm talking about, but I'm just trying to put this out there, which is, you know, they defend against Trojans and other things like this, DDoS, attacks or whatever, and it's not working, you have to know what else to do. You have to know where your defense is wrong and what else to do. But this is all various types of risk management, and it is all event-driven, and nothing really matters except whether or not you have the right insight. If you have the right insight, you could be a young hacker at 16, get busted for hacking, then go work for the NSA and be a genius simply because you have the right insight. It has nothing to do with your age. It's kind of a fascinating field. On Wall Street, you'll see these young guys who have the right insight and can manage risk, and some of them make disgusting amounts of money very quickly for their age. That's the way militaries, they don't promote like they used to promote. You know, there was a time where you had the right insight and you could be a young man on the field, on the battlefields of, in the Roman Empire, and you'd probably be a general in no time because you had the right insight. That doesn't really so much happen so more in, as much in the military, but it can. It can if you start having enough generals get whacked in a war or something. Some young colonel with the right insight can sail up through, or some young lieutenant or whatever. But it all comes down to having the right insight. But our enemy actually had the right insight in regards to hard assets, the lender of last resort. But they would have had this well prepared for. Yeah, they're never scared of what we think they're scared of. They're never scared of what we think they're scared of. And I'll talk about some things within America, because I was asked a question about something Bob Whitaker goes over. But the current financial situation in America is tenuous. And typically they're not time-driven, any more than I'm time-driven. So if Horace the Avenger was faced with something that I become time-driven, or that I have to move within a period of time, I don't really have to do that. My enemy has to move. Thank goodness. Because you don't want a clock on your head. That's what really they have. They have a clock on their head. This is the first time ever that they've had a clock on their head, maybe in hundreds of years. It's really fascinating. And it all comes down to the classic problem of the lender of last resort. They don't have it for housing. They don't have it, and it's a spiral. So they've had a clock on their head. And this is why, this is one of the biggest reasons why. And I'm going to come back to this when it comes to the Hormuz Straits and what they're concerned about with Iran, because now they have a clock on their head. They're facing financial problems for the first time in a long time. They don't have their New World Order. We're still having this conversation. This is kind of fascinating. But they would have had to had things figured out ahead of time, because they don't have the type of time they want you to think they have. They just don't, financially. They don't. Once the spiral starts, you've got other host of problems to deal with. So let's go over some of their other problems internal to America. I will come back to this financial problem when we talk about Iran and we talk about Stuxnet, the actual virus. In a little bit, I'll come back to that, but I'm going to talk about a scenario internal to America that none of the constitutionalists ever talk about. And I'll answer your questions about what old Bob said about this, or what their particular plans are, his particular plans are. And now a word from our sponsor. Have you ever said to yourself, gee, I would love an undercover lover? Or maybe you said to yourself, gee, I would like to be an undercover lover. We know exactly how you feel. For a limited time only, on WhiteRabbitRadio.net, you can buy an undercover lover. You can be an undercover lover. Yes, for only 25 carats. It is a great investment, because all the money goes to fight white rabbit genocide, which is the thing we're about here at WhiteRabbitRadio.net. So if you're looking for an undercover lover, or if you're looking to be an undercover lover, or if you're just looking to have the coolest undercover lover in the history of the undercover lovers, we have just the ticket for you, all at a very, very low price. Yeah, so hop on over there and pull up that merchandise tab. And when you see the undercover lover, you'll go wild at how beautiful it is. And hit that buy button. Support fighting white rabbit genocide in the easiest way possible. Be an undercover lover. In America, we have a constitutional republic. A constitutional republic, not really a democracy, It's not a democracy at all. It's a constitutional republic. And the highest law in the land is still the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution. I've been asked questions about Bob. Bob used to talk a great deal about posterity. Posterity is a word in the Constitution that none of the constitutionalists on TV will ever talk about. We have a constitutional republic founded to maintain posterity, for us and our posterity. It says so in the founding documents. The highest law in the land is the Constitution, and it says for us and our posterity. What is Bob talking about? Well, posterity basically means kith or kin. The founding fathers didn't found the country for Arabs. They're not Arabs. The founding fathers didn't found it for Chinese. They're not Chinese. The founding fathers of America did not found the country Africans. They're not Africans. This is just common sense. Were Africans allowed to vote? No. No. It's just, it's a constitutional republic founded to maintain posterity. Posterity means kith or kin. Now, you could argue whether it should have been just Northern European. They have these arguments. But you can't really argue that it was founded for non-Europeans. Well, what happens if you have a constitutional republic founded to maintain posterity? In 1965, America was 90% Indo-European. Right now, by the way, China is 90% Chinese. The Chinese are not 100% Chinese. They're 90% Chinese or 91%. China is basically as Chinese as America was European in 1965. What happens if you have a constitutional republic founded to maintain posterity, and then you end up trying to subvert posterity basically through an immigration law that was never voted on? There was no constitutional convention or none of the formal process. All the formal processes were thrown out the window, and they basically lied it into effect and have since tried to change posterity. Have basically tried to totally change the population. Well, you're subverting the Constitution. That's what he's telling you. You can't take the highest law in the land, and many of the constitutionalists know this. You can't overthrow the First Amendment. Damn, no, they try. They have tried, but they've really kind of failed at that. We still have it. You really can't go down that road without really committing treason. And that's really what it is. The constitutional lays out, a constitutional republic founded to maintain posterity is dependent on loyalty. Disloyalty is really simple. In any country, disloyalty is called treason. In America, it's problematic because it's still a hanging trial. You know, America is the only white country that you can hang for treason. So when it comes to the constitutionalists, they always talk about the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, all these different things that are unconstitutional, or things that people are trying that are unconstitutional, and they're actually right, or different attempts to subvert the Constitution. But what Bob is telling you, pointing out the obvious, he's telling you where you have them is not in any of those things. Any of those things would be a trial, and maybe on a given day and the given political platform, you could do some stuff and say they tried to subvert gun rights. But what they've tried to subvert is the Constitution as a whole by subverting posterity. They've tried to change posterity. They've tried to change the actual founding gene pool. They've denied the founding gene pool, the Indo-European gene pool. They've tried to deny them the privilege of continuing to run the country and all this other types of stuff, that things that go with it. If you have a constitutional republic that's founded to maintain posterity, the highest law in the land is the Constitution. You can't try to subvert that. To try to do so is treason. It's a hanging trial. That's what he's trying to tell you. Within America, believe it or not, that's one of their biggest concerns. Their concerns isn't free speech. You can't really bust them for that. But I'm talking about what they're guilty of, what they're caught cold. They're caught cold in an attempted genocide of Indo-European children. We've talked about potential tribunals in Europe, and they won't hesitate to call them. But in America, there is a really, really vicious and brutal attack that could happen, and that is under the Constitution. Because under the right political circumstances, it is, depending on who you talk to, it's a trial or a tribunal. You cannot commit that type of, you can't try to overthrow the Constitution. You just can't do that. It doesn't matter what type of Masonic fraternity you belong to, or what type of banking, how much money your family has. You just can't go there. Because if you don't succeed in some perfect multiracial republic in 2050, if you don't succeed in rearranging things, if you fail, it's a hanging trial. You know, it's just like wiping out Indo-European children. If you want to go down that road, once you commit yourself, you better succeed. Because if you don't succeed, you're in a tribunal. Someone's going to be wise enough to throw you into a loop you're not going to get out of. My enemy has more enemies than you can imagine, and most of them are non-white, believe it or not. I mean, the Chinese, there's elements of the Chinese that would love no better than to see treason tribunals and to see them hang in Washington or anywhere else. The Japanese, elements of the Japanese, especially the Japanese, I shouldn't say elements in Russia, major elements in Russia, would like nothing better. They don't care how you get them, just get them. But that is a problem they face internal America. I've never really talked about it explicitly as I just did, simply because I don't want to get you too excited. But that's the typical type of thing conservatives do, so-called conservatives. They'll talk about the Constitution, and they'll talk about, you know, they're trying to subvert the Constitution, but they will not talk about where they have them cold. You won't hear Glenn Beck doing this. You won't hear Rush Limbaugh doing this, because that's their job. Their job is not to tell you. Their job is to lead you astray. Their job is always to lead you astray. They're never going to point you in the direction of where you have them lock, stock, and two smoking barrels. It's open and shut case. There'd be plenty of evidence. Plenty of evidence on an open attempt to subvert the Constitution. You can't do that. You can't do that. And as long as the Constitution is standing, you can't do that. You can't fool with it. Now, I don't know all the legal ins and outs. Bob has a good idea of it, or he wouldn't talk about it. But that's his type of thinking. Bob's type of thinking is, we're going to take down an opponent by any means necessary, using the law, but never breaking the law. That is practical politics. That is non-voting politics. And there's plenty of elements in America that could probably get that done, especially on the right political circumstances. And we are right there, aren't we? But you can't attempt to subvert the Constitution. That's the wonderful thing about white rabbit genocide, is there's a handful of different ways to get them, because they've broken the law. When you break the law, and you break it, big laws, well, there's big ways to get you. This is what Bob is talking about with posterity, for us and our posterity. It is a serious word. It's a serious word in a serious document. People always talk about the Declaration of Independence. That's not the highest law in the land. That's just a war document. All right, maybe an elegant construct. It may be significant in the founding documents of America, but it's not the Constitution. It's not the highest law in the land. Now, I'm not a big constitutionalist. I just want to see an enemy fall. But that is what Bob is talking about. And that is the biggest kink in their armor within America. The genocide charge is important under international law. That's a big deal. But the subversion of the Constitution is ruthless, brutal, and efficient, if caught. I mean, a constitutional republic founded to maintain posterity, it doesn't matter whether it's in Saudi Arabia or anywhere else on this planet, or America, is founded in its founding documents, is basically telling you you have to maintain some loyalty. And disloyalty, of course, is always treason. Yeah, you can't try to get rid of the Indo-European population of America. You can't try to do that without violating the Constitution. You cannot. That's what Bob is saying, basically. And he can make the argument much more elegant than I can. I'm no constitutional scholar. Never will be. But I can guarantee you Obama isn't either. I can guarantee you all these little fast-yapping lawyers whose last names always rhyme with, like, Ginsburg or something, they call themselves constitutional scholars and constitutional lawyers, are always peddling their BS around this stuff. But when push comes to shove, there won't be any peddling BS, because America still has a huge, huge white population. They just have to know that there's been an outright attempt to genocide them, and under international law, that has teeth. And in this outright attempt to genocide them, there's been a subversion of the Constitution. Not maybe a subversion, not maybe a trial for Second Amendment or the First Amendment, not maybe, but an outright attempt to subvert the Constitution by changing posterity. There's been no convention, there's been no vote, there's been no public discussion. It's not allowed. And that is, well, it's treason, isn't it? Well, that's what Bob is saying. Bob will always point out where you have them, and typically where we think we have them is not. And where we have them is something that, oh, we haven't talked about that. Well, we are basically have a whole entire media, especially the conservatives, and by and large the liberals too, that'll constantly keep you running around or keep you off center or keep you thinking about something that won't work. Really, you know, they'll have you thinking about something that won't work, like running around shooting someone in the head. You know, right now a congresswoman was shot in the head. They haven't really, you know, what's funny about the particular tragedy is the enemy was clearly geared up, and they always are, for any disaster to try to take advantage of it. But unlike Columbine, unlike Oklahoma City, they don't have quite the media control because of the spread of the internet. So they haven't been able to shove down, or actually it should be interesting to see what they try to shove down our throats because of it. At first they said he was a white male and everything else, which he is, or he looks white, but now it's come out that his mother's Jewish, and that why he read the Mein Kampf was to give his mother to get back at his mother or something like that. But it's come out on white news now that he was Jewish, his mother was Jewish. And of course on Jamie Kelso on White News Now produced the Mother Jones piece where it said that not only was he Jewish, but his family or elements of his family went to the same synagogue as the congresswoman, which is kind of odd. So he must have known her on some level. I don't know what's going on with it, but they don't do themselves any favor by not revealing all this because of the internet. It's going to come out, and it has been allowed to come out. There's nothing they can do to stop it. And this is another thing that's given them fits, the truth. The truth. I don't know why they wouldn't say that. Okay, he was Jewish, he freaked out, he went to the same synagogue or whatever. Just say the whole truth. By not saying it, it'll just get you in a lot more trouble. But I don't know. But this type of strategy, the type of strategy you think works to bring down a closed society never ever works. They can spin this stuff all day long. We've seen it my whole entire life, off and on. It's never once worked. It typically reinforces the system. Now, once the system starts coming down, I was asked this question. Once the system starts coming down, kind of like it is, can that stuff work? Typically, practical politics, what we're engaged in, is engaging and taking down an opponent by any means necessary, using the wall, and never breaking the law. You're not in the Wild Wild West. You can't walk around and shoot people without paying a very, very high price. And typically, again, it goes to reinforce the system. Wait till the Berlin Wall comes down. If there's a war, there's a war. If it goes back to being the Wild Wild West and you can deal steel like cornmeal, well, it's every rabbit for himself and you have to defend yourself. But until then, I mean, my job is simply to put you on a consistent message. I don't ever advocate any type of lawlessness because it doesn't work in this type of system. They brought down the Soviet Union. They never did it with bombs. They never did it with guns. We do it with words. Now, once it comes down, you can have a Yugoslavia-type situation out west. Most likely, it's tailor-made for ethnic conflict, isn't it? Because of all the different ethnicities. I have no idea about all that. But the congresswoman had no real power. She had no power to affect the system one way or another, but by shooting her, of course, you end up with a huge entire media uproar over it. Now, in this particular case, she had, you know, it wasn't some conservative constitutionalist like they tried to bill it. It was some, what looks to be a crazy Jewish kid. And that has backfired on them. It has backfired on them thus far, But that type of strategy they'll always try to spin it to something that will help perpetuate the system, and they usually get their way. They've always gotten their way, in fact, whether it be the crackdown after everything. Everything you're going to look at, they're going to try to use this to benefit and to basically perpetuate the system. Because violence always perpetuates a system based on ethnic conflict and violence. You know, everyone always thinks you can run around, shoot people, and bring down a government, but you can't. You've never seen a closed system in this world. We've never seen one brought down that way. We've never seen one brought down through bombs. We've never seen one brought down under conventional, what they want you to think. They want you to think this type of thing brings down closed societies. It does not. They're a closed society because they say they own the truth regarding race in only white countries. That's what makes the West a big closed society. But they don't want you on a consistent message. They don't want you on that because that is what works. They will constantly ignore people like Bob because that is what works. And it's kind of common sense. I don't want my enemy doing what works. I want him doing what doesn't work because that keeps us in power. But, you know, once the system comes down, that's when Yugoslavia happens. It doesn't happen before. At least we haven't seen it thus far. But no nutball shooting a woman in Congress without any power, really. Without any power. She's a symbol of power, certainly. He also capped a federal judge, which is a symbol of power. Would Sir ever, especially not one, like that particular incident, typically goes to perpetuate the system. Or it always has. In other words, they're going to go to put in laws in place to perpetuate their own power. It always reinforces their power. It never, ever affects them. It certainly may cause some fear among federal judges or congresspeople, but, you know, most of them are already terrified. The system's falling to pieces. So stay on a consistent message and don't ever listen to someone that tells you to break the law because that doesn't work. doesn't work in this type of system. All it does is get people thrown in jail and get things off course. What works is what no one will ever talk about. What works is simple things, the broken record strategy, as Bob calls it. You know, pointing out the conflict in that, the point of contention in that closed society and doing it over and over again. We do that with the mantra. And now a word from our sponsor. Horace, I've been wearing my Undercover Lover t-shirt nonstop all summer. Haven't even took it off to wash. Well, you may want to take it off to wash, and you may want to put it away for the winter or wear it underneath your new Undercover Lover hoodie, because we've got the deal for you. You don't need to be walking around Norway and Germany with just a t-shirt on all winter, unless, of course, you want to wear it over top of your snowmobile suit. Yes, you go get yourself a Undercover Lover hoodie. Zip up or pull over in multiple different colors, all for a very, very low starting price of $39.95. And it's just in time for Santa Claus. And it's just in time to support our servers, right at Christmas time. So you hop on over there to whiterabbitradio.net, and you get yourself an Undercover Lover hoodie to go with your t-shirt. Yes. And now back to our regular programming. Now we'll get back to economics, and we're going to tie it in, and I'm going to talk about Iran. I'm going to answer some questions and some ideals I have on Stuxnet. It's Stust, S-T-U-X-N-E-N-E-T. Stuxnet virus. Well, actually, it's not a virus. There's the first piece of information. It's a worm. This person's asking about a virus. It's an actual worm. It gets in there, and once it gets in there, it sits quietly, and then it starts infecting things. And this one is an industrial virus. It causes machines to move out of control and everything else. And how successful was the attack? I mean, most of us watching TV would think this little worm shut down Iran's nuclear program for quite a while. It wreaked havoc. It's, you know, according to Meir Dagan, I think it was in Israel, that it set them back to 2015 or something like that. That is all propaganda. That is all propaganda. And there's a big story with the Stuxnet virus. And the big story with the worm. It's not a virus, it's a worm. Is that, the big story would be that it got all the way in there. It was a brilliant attack. It'll go down in the history of warfare. And it is one of the great big cyber attacks ever. It got in, it penetrated the system, and in other words, someone introduced it into the system. Those big nuclear reactors and all that, all the Bashir power plant and all that type of stuff. They're not exactly attached to the internet. So someone had to get inside and introduce it, and this time it was introduced through a USB drive. And it is an industrial worm that shuts down Siemens. It has something to do with Siemens AG in Germany. It attacks certain industrial equipment. It makes the motors speed up. And I'll put up some news pieces. You can read all about it. But basically, it was pretty devastating that someone could penetrate that deep. Pretty devastating that someone could introduce a worm. And that worm was allowed to propagate and was allowed to do some amount of damage. No one knows. Everyone speculates on how much. But the story that everyone's missing is that Iran actually found out about it. I'm going to repeat that. That Iran actually found out about it. Because here we have one of the first brilliant cyber attacks in the history of cyber warfare. I mean, they actually penetrated, got all the way in, introduced it through some type of USB drive, and the Persians aren't going to be all that sophisticated when dealing with this type of thing. I mean, Siemens AG had to come up with a solution. So here we have someone that gets all that way in. Someone designed an industrial virus. I'm sorry, industrial worm. It's very easy to mix up the two. I'm not a cyber guru, but it's an industrial worm to attack something specifically. They believe Iran, and I have no reason to disbelieve it because that's what it attacked first. It gets all the way inside. Someone introduced it into the system. And it basically speeds up electrical components and starts wreaking havoc. It starts propagating. It starts shutting down, moving from machine to machine. The Iranians didn't detect it right away. Obviously, it got in. You know, if someone introduces a worm on your computer and you don't know about it and it starts doing damage, it's because you didn't detect it. That's kind of common sense. So the question becomes, how did they detect it? How did they detect it? Are the Persians technological gurus? Are they geniuses? Well, they didn't build the Bashir plant to begin with. It was built by Russians. They buy all their stuff from outside Iran. They don't have a semiconductor industry or a computer industry. That's just minimal. Everything they have has been bought and brought in there, right? By and large, except things like cement, where they make themselves. But this is the story. How did they find out about it? There's only a handful of parties in the world sophisticated enough to pull that off. I don't know about, there's controversy. Some people believe that your average hacker could make a worm like this if they wanted to. I don't have those technical abilities, so I have no idea. But we can all agree that only a handful of parties on this planet can actually pull something like that off. An actual worm introduced into the Bashir plant that starts wreaking havoc on the electrical components. Only a handful of parties are going to be able to pull that off on this planet. And we all know who these parties are. It's the Germans, it's the Israeli, maybe to a lesser extent the French, the Russians, the Chinese, the Americans. Americans don't have a first strike. They don't really have a cyber attack type policy, but they're an Anglosphere. So you got the UK, MI6, that type of thing. The Mossad obviously would be first on the list. And since then, of course, we've had an outright war within the Iranian nuclear management structure. You got scientists being shot, and they got an Israeli spy now. They said they busted the whole entire ring. So who knows? Who knows what the whole truth is? But allow me to point out the obvious and something that no one is talking about. How in the hell did Iran find out about it? Because if Iran had not found out about it, it would have the capabilities of shutting down their whole entire nuclear program. I mean, as it stands, your best case scenario is that it shut down some components. I mean, it shut down some components, according to the Israelis, maybe to 2015. But your worst case scenario is it only shut them down for a couple months. And that's assuming these parts weren't going to be replaced anyways, or they didn't have replacements for them. There's a lot of assumptions. But they've admit that the Iranians admit that it caused some problems, so we'll assume that it did. But that isn't the story here. The story here is it should have shut the damn thing down. Because if you didn't detect it, and it's going wild, how'd you find out about it? And the answer is quite simple. And this is the devastating part of it. The answer is that the reason they found out about it is that someone told them about it. In other words, someone sophisticated enough, or have their heads to the ground listening, one of the spy agencies, someone liked Iran enough to tell them that it was there, it was active. Someone told them enough so they could find it. They found it. Siemens now issued a patch because now the thing's a global problem potentially. And the damage that could have been catastrophic was somewhat mitigated. We don't know how much, but somewhat. And I mean, it didn't slow down their uranium enrichment. That is a lot of propaganda. I mean, there's still, I'm going to put up some different events. The one of the most optimistic that it only helped hurt for a couple months. And I'll read it to you. So as a bit of software, all it will take to stop a rogue nuclear program? Probably not. Wired magazine has pointed out that a similar worm could hurt North Korea's nuclear program, but only if someone could infiltrate its heavily defended facilities in the first place. More important, the Stuxnet virus attack just slowed down the Bashir plant for a couple months. Iran has successfully added large amounts of enriched uranium to its stockpile since. So this is a case which is probably more realistic than the BS media we're getting. And this is from a major news source. Let's look. It's from the Telegraph in the UK. This is Praveen Swamy, and he's an Indian who knows something about tech. But this is an interesting piece. I'll put it up. But the real story is who told him about it. Because only a handful of people are sophisticated enough to do this type of thing, and that's get it in there. Get it in there, plant it in there. Only a handful would even, someone had to squeal on this. Someone had to tell Iran, because they're not all that sophisticated. If they were all that sophisticated, they would have built a nuclear power plant themselves, and they would have detected the damn thing early on. I mean, the thing wouldn't have done hardly any damage at all if they were that sophisticated, right? I mean, as soon as you stick in a USB, but, it's a brilliant attack. You have to give credit where credit's due. But the real story here is the attack should have shut the thing down. The attack should be still ongoing. This little worm keeps digs in there, and it keeps spreading and propagating, or however they call it, from USB drive to USB drive. Once it gets into one system, all these networks, it's going to start infecting. Siemens should still not even know about it. Siemens shouldn't know about it to actually produce something to stop it. But someone actually told Iran. Iran actually had to go looking for it. And there's a lot of propaganda out about how they did that. But I got a simple explanation. Someone told them. Someone told them. That is the only logical explanation, is that one of these parties had an interest in telling Iran. And that's the real story here. And that's the big event. I mean, right now there's a big mole hunt. There's a big mole hunt in America and the NSA, and they believe there's a Russian spy in the NSA. A big Russian spy in the NSA. And Russia, of course, believes in the boots on the ground type of intelligence. The Anglo elites use speed of information, where the Russians put boots on the ground. In other words, where one group would try to get information or get some kind of outside source to get information on Russian intelligence, the Russians take an opposite approach. They take a long-term view. Instead of having speed of attack or some type of short-term view, they take a long-term view and will try to get boots on the ground within the NSA spying for Russia. The Anglo elites kind of take a little bit different approach, but I think I've talked about this type of thing before, but right now they're hunting for that mole. So I don't know exactly who told the Iranians about it. There was speculation that it was the Chinese. We have the Chinese. We know that elements of Chinese are selling massive, have sold massive weapons, massive different surprise elements to Iran. We know that's why they didn't buy the S-300. Iran wasn't still concerned with buying the S-300 from Russia, because guess what? The biggest purchaser of S-300s in the world and the biggest manufacturer or buyer of the parts is the Chinese, and the Chinese have a duplicate system called the F-2000 or something like that. It's very similar to S-300. It's a cross between the S-300 and one of the older Patriot models, like a Patriot 3 or Patriot 2 or something. So the reason they weren't interested in buying the S-300 is because they most likely got that from China, and that China just put that on the export market. So if China's putting that on an export market, they're not going to have any scruples about getting that to Iran, or they could even, who knows? Who knows what's really going on? But the big story with Stuxnet, the Stuxnet worm, is that they found out about it. Who in the hell told them? Because had they not known about it, it would just be wreaking havoc as I speak. This thing is deadly. It was a brilliant attack. All the way, very successful up until Iran found out about it. I mean, something like that is going to work until it shuts everything down or wreaks total havoc. Or until someone finds out about it. But someone told them about it. Someone had to have the expertise or the know. Someone had to be in the know. Someone had to have a peek at the cards or know about it ahead of time or tell them about it. So that's the real story here, that they found out about it. Forget about them holding up their nuclear program. They're still enriching uranium. They're still carrying on. The real story here is who told them about it. How'd they find out about it? You know, everyone's talking about it. Who actually did the attack? And no one's really talking. Mossad, MI6, who knows? Who knows? Who knows who did it? There's a lot of speculation on that. We could probably say probably the Mossad, but they're not admitting to it. But the real story is who told them about it. Who told them about it? Because the attack was brilliant. It was a brilliant attack. But who likes Iran enough to tell them about it? Who wants that nuclear program in place enough to tell them about it? Because there's no way they'd have the expertise on their own to find out about it. If they would have had that, they would have noticed it earlier. Because the thing was wreaking havoc. Whatever little part it was attacking at the Bashir power plant, it was just starting to get going. The thing was, it would go nonstop until it shut everything down. Until it sped up all the electrical equipment and wore the electrical equipment out or whatever. The thing works and it is pretty ingenious. But they didn't detect it until one day. And the question is how they detected it. And it is really simple. Someone told them about it. Someone wanted them to know about it. Someone in the know wanted them to know. It's kind of like how they get a nuclear power plant to begin with. Well, someone wanted them to have it. You know, someone white. So this is rather fascinating. But the big challenge with Iran, you know, the Anglo-American elites, they don't like the North Korea thumbing their nose at them over nuclear power. They don't like Iran thumbing their nose at them over nuclear power. Israeli really doesn't like this Iran nuclear business, because obviously for common sense reasons. It changes the whole balance in the Middle East. But the big thing is the Straits of Hormuz. The Straits of Hormuz have always been a problem because obviously we have a petrodollar. You have the Federal Reserve Bank as the largest private central bank in the history of the world. That's another podcast. If you don't understand what I mean, go back and listen to my spiel on the difference between private and public central banks. And so we have a petrodollar. People say that the dollar is not backed by anything. That is ignorance. It's backed by every commodity in the world, and the biggest commodity in the world is oil. All oil is priced in dollars. There's a Russian exception right now, but typically, by and large, most of the oil in the world right now is priced in dollars. The reason for that is because America has, so what's behind the dollar? What's behind the dollar? It's a petrodollar. It's an inverted link. In other words, the dollar is not backed by gold, but all the oil in the world is priced in dollars, and oil is the biggest commodity. Or all the commodities in the world are priced in dollars, and oil is the biggest commodity. Everyone needs oil, and oil is priced in dollars. It's a lender of last resort. That's how they got around it. It's kind of ingenious. So people that say that the dollar is not backed by anything, well, it's called a petrodollar. It's not called that for no reason. But the U.S. doesn't have any petro. The U.K. doesn't have really any petro. These guys don't have any petro. The U.S. is the largest natural gas producer in the world, but not the largest oil gas producer. That's Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, of course, is an obvious example because it's easy to get to. Siberia has not always been easy to get to. Oil technology has come a long ways, but Saudi Arabia was always easy to get to. It's a desert. You can drill right to it. I mean, it's sitting on a large pool of oil. And so our relationship with Saudi Arabia and our relationship in the Middle East revolves around Israel, and it also revolves around oil. And one can be just as important as the other, because guess what? If you block the Straits of Hormuz, you send oil prices through the roof. But another thing you do is you stop shipments of a great deal of oil, and a great deal of that oil is priced in dollars. Now, normally this would be untenable. They're not going to let you do that. That's why there's always a military presence there. There's a huge military presence there because this is the big card Iran has. It's like the sword of Damocles over the Anglo elite's head. The difference between, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, this is untenable. They will not allow them to keep pushing their buttons on the Straits of Hormuz because it could threaten a great deal of Anglo power in regards to banking. Common sense. If you can shut off oil supplies priced in dollars, if you can wreak havoc among the oil, you can wreak havoc among the financial security of the Anglo elites. But let's go back to what I just told you about housing. Housing is a big problem. Housing has no lender of last resort. Housing market in America, it may have picked up in some parts of Los Angeles because of foreign buyers. It may pick up in some parts of New York because of foreign buyers. But there's a lot of flyover country with no buyers. It's a problem. It's a problem. Problems get reactions. Reactions get solutions. The solution is a lender of last resort, liquidity, but they can't. You just don't open up the discount window and prop up home prices like they can do stocks and stuff like that. It just doesn't work, and it's a disaster. So if shutting down the Straits of Hormuz would be untenable to them most other times, what happens if you threaten to do it when they're reeling from a real crisis? A housing crisis. In other words, you shut down the Straits of Hormuz now, and you're going to have, you could have potential catastrophe in the American economy, as well as the dollar economy of the world. The whole world's geared toward dollars right now. The last time you switched from British pound sterling to U.S. dollars was the Great Depression. The world reserve status, in other words, oil was priced in cable. Oil was priced in pound sterling, and the commodities of the world was priced in pound sterling. Then that moved, that reserve status moved, this link sort of moved from the United Kingdom to the U.S. And of course, both at that time had the gold standard. The U.K. had the gold standard, the U.S. had the gold standard, but that was during the Great Depression. And right now, housing prices are getting the Great Depression. So, are they planning on moving reserve status to China? Well, there's two sides to China. That becomes a dice roll. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that in the next MP3. But what I'm trying to tell you is the Stuxnet virus was a disaster in so much as that it didn't shut down the program. Someone has an inside card to their plays. Obviously, if Iran found out about it, everyone's saying they were so clever. No, someone had to tell them about it. They're not that clever. They're not that clever. They would have built a nuclear power plant themselves. It's common sense. Someone had to tell them that someone's going to be white or Chinese potentially or Japanese, I think. But someone had to be sophisticated enough to have an inside peek at the cards of whoever wanted to attack them. And there's a short list. And wanted them to get the information. But the threat the Iranians pose to the Straits of Hormuz is now beyond untenable. Beyond untenable because they can't have another crisis. They have one crisis that demands a lender of last resort. There is no lender of last resort for housing. This is the problem to private central bank that's been pricked. And so they're kind of out of time in that area. Time is something they don't go by. They go by events. They had all this stuff set up for their New World Order between 1960, whatever it is. There was a 100-year plan. Anytime we will have our New World Order. And we will keep running our game, running our racket until we have it. Makes sense. If you had that amount of time, you could run your game. My race could not sit spread out over all this land and maintain these attacks against us for 100 years. Something's going to, I mean, until 2050, something would have to change. But the big problem is who has thrown a monkey wrench on their timetable? Because right now, these guys are preparing to go to war. That's precisely what they're doing. I've talked about this. This is one event, obviously, I'm looking for. This is the last big leaf. This is the one where the fog of the endgame will start lifting rapidly afterwards. But it's already, we're already peeking through. Someone has an inside look at their cards, and someone is playing them into these events. Now, what can send us to war with Iran? Well, like I said, one incident will send us to war because their control of the Straits of Hormuz is untenable. They cannot allow that. And who knows what the Chinese have planned? Who knows? I mean, when you spread out across the world and the whole world hates you, like we are, who knows who's going to slip on the Mickey? You know, as an American, that's one thing I worry about. Who knows what someone's done out there to slip the Anglo elites the Mickey? You know, but they cannot tolerate, forget about the nuclear stuff for a minute, with what's going on internally in American economics, with this housing problem, this classic crisis that the private central bankers, the lender of last resort, they cannot tolerate someone threatening to close the Straits of Hormuz. Now, how can they end that? Well, they would have to do an air attack, an all-out air attack, and get them out of there. Because Iran threatens the Straits of Hormuz every second. Every second. Any given second, an incident could blow it up. They cannot tolerate that right now. Any given time, it would be untenable. But with all these other stimuli and input, there's a problem. I mean, that's going to get a reaction. So, you know, their main focus in this particular event or any potential incident or event is making sure the Straits of Hormuz stay open, because if that doesn't stay open, we have oil problems. Oil problems mean dollar problems. It's all connected. It's one big chain. And when it rains, it pours. When it rains, it pours. That means when the crisis comes, it's going to really come. But they've been facing crisis after crisis, and they're reeling from it. The people that want us to believe they're running the universe have problems. They're right in front of your face. They have huge problems. Now, our job is pretty simple. Our job is to obey the law and stay on a consistent message as it moves, especially moving into YouTube as much as possible. You guys are doing a great job. I will entertain you until the end, until we smell the rot of the pink rabbits, but it's starting to smell sour. The people that want us to believe they are running the universe, they have big problems. Problems internally, and maybe even in their own group. I mean, how did Iran find out about this? Who squealed? Who told them? You know, forget about their nuclear program. Let's step back a minute. Someone's got a peek at the cards, and what exactly is waiting at the Straits of Hormuz? Now, common sense, it's just all about, you know, you follow the trail of the money. They cannot allow them to sit over the Straits of Hormuz. Israel has backed down, and Israel is now letting the Saudi Arabias beat the war drum. Israel's done its job, especially in the U.S. media. I mean, the Jew rabbits pretty much own the media, or the Jewish elites do, and they've been beating the drums of war against Iran for a long time. Especially the neocons. You know, the liberals will take, we don't need to go to war with Iran. The neocons will say, we need to go with the war with Iran. And then in the end, they'll agree and they'll start coming on a consistent message, planting the meme, coming back to the meme stronger and stronger. But the poll ratings for a war have risen dramatically over the past 10 years, especially over the past probably 24 months. Most Americans, it has it in their mind that there could be a potential war in Iran, which is their job. But now that their job is done, why would Israel back off? Because it really doesn't serve their purpose if they know that there's a war coming. In other words, if they have a date for a war and they know that the Anglo elite must go to war for the Straits of Hormuz, etc., well, then they'll have an open opportunity to bomb the nuclear facilities, or the Anglo elite might do it for them, or so on and so forth. They most likely would join up for this one. I don't really know what exactly is going to trigger it. I just know it's going to trigger. But this Strait of Hormuz business and Iran's position of strength, which it keeps building in the Muslim world, the Shia crescent, has caused problems. And now, of course, Iran, the big spotlight's on the big meeting in Turkey, and I don't expect anything to happen from it. I think these meetings are basically, I mean, if Israel is kicking back and talking about we don't need a war till 2015, what that tells me is it's coming any day, probably. That's the way I look at it. I look at the direct opposite. It doesn't mean war isn't coming. It means they know war is coming, so why beat the drums for it? And, you know, and so I think this meeting with Turkey is it's interesting to see how the dynamics in the Middle East play out, because the House of Saud, of course, is a benefactor of the Anglo elite, which is a benefactor, you know, it's all tied to this dollar and the petrodollar and all this stuff we went into. But the Straits of Hormuz would give the Saudis, it just wreaks havoc on the whole entire area. And that is untenable because of our dependence on oil and our dependence on a currency that is indirectly backed by oil. And of course the Israelis know all that. What the Israelis do is they fear, and there is somewhat something to fear. The Arabs fear the Persians for good reason. The Arabs annihilate the Persians and destroy their ancient empire. So, you know, there is some amount of fear, but the Israelis will go out of their way to stoke that fear. But there's no point in them beating the war drums if a war is a foregone conclusion and someone has a date. There's no point in them continuing to do that, because all that's going to do is increase anti-Semitism. But they just did something in Lebanon, too, and Lebanon's always something to watch. They just created some instability in Lebanon. And these are the type of moves I expect to see as we are in the beginning stages of the end game. We're in the opening attack sequences. And then things will really pick up when the incident happens. The incident sends us to war with Iran. They cannot allow Iran to sit there and threaten the Straits of Hormuz. They can't, and they can do something about it. They can do a conventional air campaign and get them out of there. We think. I don't know what's going to take place, and I don't know what can of worms it's going to open. But Stuxnet is an interesting story, and the story that's not being told is who the hell told them about it. I mean, we're talking about a brilliant attack, a brilliant industrial attack that could have crippled their nuclear reactor. Because let's face it, they didn't have the technical expertise to put that in there. That's all important. So who did it? Who did it? And more importantly, and when I say who did it, who told them about it? How'd they find out about it? And you, of course, have a little war within Iran's nuclear community, with some of them dying and they're pulling out Mossad spies, or so they say. It's the fog of the endgame. But as usual, the big news events, at least to me, are the ones that don't end up on Fox News. War will happen before 2015. They don't have time. They don't have time economically. They cannot allow these guys to sit over the Straits of Hormuz and threaten them, because if that went up, if that goes up in a way that they can't get a handle on it and clear the thing out, and if oil prices spike unsustainably, or heavens only knows, they cannot allow that type of threat, because that would be the nail in the coffin to the dollar. That could be the nail in the coffin. Not by itself. Any other, 10 years ago, the Straits of Hormuz, they go in and clear it out. It's a mess. Oil prices spike. It hurts the American economy. We go into recession. Okay, all right, whatever. But with everything else going on, with their Achilles heel, the Achilles heel of the private central banker being pricked, the Achilles heel being stepped on, the old U.S. housing market in America, with all these other factors, stimuli and input, they cannot tolerate this. This is beyond untenable to them. Because what it does is it gives Iran control, potentially, or the ability to put a nail in their coffin. It's enough to have a housing crisis and have no lender of last resort and have to work through it. It's quite another thing to have an oil crisis or a crisis in the Straits of Hormuz at the same time. So it's something you can't allow to develop, to the extent that it would be entirely damaging to your operations, obviously. In other words, they have to prepare for Iran making a move there. They have to prepare. That's what they've been preparing for. All this stuff within the Middle East, the Straits of Hormuz, that's what they've been preparing on, demining it and getting the Iranians out of there so they can keep the oil lanes clear. And of course, the Chinese, the Russians, and everyone on Earth knows it. I mean, if you have to keep something clear, everyone on Earth is going to know about it. If you're facing a huge crisis, that would be a lender of last resort. If I know about it, that means a lot of their other enemies know about it. If they have to keep the Straits of Hormuz open and oil lanes open to try to keep this dollar, this U.S. dollar afloat, and this private central banking scheme, the U.S. Federal Reserve, it's all combined. If I know about it, I assume that all their enemies know about it. Heavens only knows what they've done to cause them problems. Because someone is giving the Iranians a peek at the cards. Someone is. And of course, to cause problems in the Straits of Hormuz, all you need is a bunch of jihadists and be willing to die. Which I'm gonna bet money Iran has. and they've been preparing for this a long time. So it should be interesting to see how it starts, exactly what happens in Israel, because this, in my opinion, will be the big debacle. It will be the big debacle. But at the same time, they cannot allow Iran, they cannot allow this little state to sit there and dictate the terms or the potential to cause their banking structure to rip it down any more than it has been ripped down at the Straits of Hormuz. They cannot allow this. I mean, this is untenable to them. So, and with housing and a crisis and everything else like that, they cannot allow it to go on, in my opinion, too much longer. But this is something they would have came to a conclusion on a few years ago, believe it or not. Yeah, they're forward thinking. They know that the moves would be Iran going nuclear. They could probably even game that or work around that, especially the banksters, the pink rabbit banksters. But when it comes down to the Straits of Hormuz, you're threatening their power directly. You're threatening the dollar. You're threatening reserve status. You're threatening, and with all these other problems internal in America economically, it's not a time for, right now oil is at $90-some. And it's $91. That's not what they want to see right now. But they would have been well prepared. So what they're willing to do or what incident sends us to war, I don't know. But the big story is not the story they're talking about on the news. But we'll keep on a consistent message, and I will keep on entertaining you, and there'll be more MP3s to come. We are now at the end of another episode of Horace the Avengers Follow the White Rabbit. And this podcast is, of course, all as always, dedicated to practical politics. But I'd like to take this time to thank you for tuning in to another episode. On behalf of the Indigenous White Rabbits of Europe, it is yours truly, Horace the Avenger. And I'll be back with you in another episode in the near future. Until then, thank you for listening.